So there was a man named Arthur Sackler who was born in 1913. And from a very young age, he wanted to do something that was meaningful with his life. He wanted his life to be full of purpose and he wanted to make a name for himself. So as a boy, he started working with his father in his father's grocery store. And then when he was a teenager and finished school, he studied medicine. But as he was studying medicine, the Great Depression hit and he saw his father lose his business and had to declare bankruptcy. He lost most of what he had been working so hard for. And I think this had a big impact on Arthur. And because Arthur was the oldest son in his family, kind of the responsibility fell on him to care for his family. So he had two younger brothers as well, and he encouraged his two younger brothers to go into medicine. And he, as well as studying medicine, had multiple jobs to try and support his family. And when he finished his degree, he started his residency at a mental asylum while also working part-time as a copywriter for a pharmaceutical company. And working for a mental asylum in those days was kind of appalling. The conditions that people lived in these institutions were terrible, and there was kind of no hope for them. And so he became really convicted that he wanted to help people, and he thought if we could just develop the right pill and change people's brain chemistry, then people could find healing and hope and actually leave these institutions. And so that became his passion. Now, Arthur was a very clever man, and he also seemed to have enormous capacity to be able to do a lot. So he was involved in lots of different jobs all around the pharmaceutical industry. And his brothers got into this line of work as well. And Arthur was particularly groundbreaking when it came to medical advertising. He kind of revolutionized medical advertising. And one of the products that he got given to promote was this new drug, Valium. As it was coming onto the market, he ended up promoting it. And he was so good at it that he and his family became quite wealthy in the process. Now, Arthur was also an incredibly generous man, so he often made donations to particularly art galleries. He had a particular interest in ancient Chinese art, so he collected all these pieces and then he would often donate these pieces to art galleries, as long as his name was also kind of plastered on the gallery as well. In many ways, Arthur reflects a lot of what we were talking about last week. This was a man who was doing work that helped his community to flourish. And it just so happened in the process, it made his family prosper as well. And so, in the end, all his jobs kind of, and it wasn't always known because he was also a very secretive man, but they all kind of helped create almost an empire for the Sacklers, where they were involved in the whole process around creating drugs and marketing drugs. And here is a quote that kind of describes how their business worked.
The Sackler Empire is a completely integrated operation. They could develop a drug, have it clinically tested, secure favorable reports from the doctors and hospitals with which they had connections, devise an advertising campaign in their agency, publish the clinical articles and the advertisements in their own medical journals, and use their public relations muscle to place articles in newspapers and magazines.
Now, I don't know if you hear any warning bells as you hear this quote, but somewhere along the way, the work they were doing, I think, became a little bit distorted. The Sacklers owned a family business called Purdue, and the next generation of Sacklers in 1996 developed a drug, quite a well-known drug, and launched it onto the market, oxycodone. Now, at the time, they wanted to address chronic pain. Chronic pain wasn't a big issue. Doctors didn't often consider how to help people suffering from chronic pain. It was kind of something I guess you had to live with for most of history. But they started a foundation trying to bring awareness of pain and pain management. They started writing articles about chronic pain. And then they developed a drug that was meant to kind of eliminate chronic pain forever. And so they released this drug onto the market and it made a lot of money, one of the fastest money makers of all time in terms of drugs. Around $34 billion was made on this drug. But this drug in time has become associated with also starting the opioid crisis that has hit particularly the US quite hard. So over 450,000 people have died of accidental overdoses in the US. So in terms of accidental deaths, it's the leading cause. You're more likely to die of an accidental overdose than a car accident or even a gunshot wound in the US. And so as more people started to know family members who had either died of overdoses or were struggling with addiction, questions started to circle back to the Sacklers and their business. Did they know how dangerous and how addictive their drug was? Did they have the right safety mechanisms in place? Were their advertising techniques too aggressive? Did they cross ethical boundaries? Was there a conflict of interest in some of these foundations and businesses that they were involved in? Did they have internal research that they covered up in order to make more money? The Sacklers and their story kind of represent to me how sometimes work has a way of becoming distorted and maybe even distorting us in the process. You know, last week we had this glorious vision in Genesis 1 and 2 about work. But that's not the only vision we see in the Bible when it comes to work. And so I want to spend some time today in the book of Ecclesiastes, which gives a very sobering vision of work. And somehow I think we need to hold both visions together. When we think about a theology of work, we need to have both of these visions in our head. The book of Ecclesiastes is a story about this man who's often called the teacher or the philosopher who's trying to discover meaning in life. And so he goes to all the places we typically go to. First, he goes to books, good place to start. And he looks at books and he thinks, if I just have the right knowledge, then I'll find the meaning in life. But then he doesn't find it there. And so then he goes and seeks pleasure. And he thinks, maybe if I just like have fun, indulge all my senses, then I'll find meaning in my life. But he doesn't find it there. And then he goes and looks at work and he thinks, maybe if I just work hard, I'll find satisfaction and meaning in life. And this is his conclusion when it comes to work.
Ecclesiastes 2, verse 17. So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless.
Sometimes work can suck. It can feel meaningless, pointless. Actually, literally the word that's translated meaningless is hevil in Hebrew, and it kind of means like vapor, breath. It's like fleeting. So even if it is satisfying, it doesn't last. You work and work, and then it just disappears. It goes. Now, this is in contrast to this vision of work that was presented in Genesis 1 and 2. Remember, work there was something that brought satisfaction, that brought joy. There was a sense of your work being an act of worship. And there's a sense of everything being in balance, right? That you're in relationship with God, relationship with one another, with the planet, and you're doing good work. But now there's an awareness of death, and death seems to shift things, and suddenly this worker finds all the joy has been leached out of him. There's no joy. He's not looking forward to work on a Monday. In fact, it just feels really repetitive, like he's doing the same thing day in and day out, and nothing changes. It doesn't contribute to any good that he can see. I don't know if that resonates with you, but sometimes... I certainly feel this. Sometimes work can suck and it can feel fruitless. Timothy Keller. I don't normally quote Timothy Keller, but he is someone who spent some time reflecting a lot on the nature of work, and he speaks about this fruitless aspect that we might encounter when we work. So here's a quote from him.
In all our work, we'll be able to envision far more than we can accomplish, both because of a lack of ability and because of resistance in the environment around us. The experience of work will include pain, conflict, envy, and fatigue, and not all our goals will be met.
Maybe that resonates with you and your experience of work at the moment. One of the other shifts that we see take place is that there's a shift or a distinction now being made between paid and unpaid work. And actually, this was a shift that took quite a long time, actually, kind of in fits and starts before this became kind of the norm in history. So it's really, I don't know, I find it fascinating looking at the history of work. And at different points, there's been certain like significant changes in work. So one of the biggest changes thousands of years ago was the agricultural revolution. So when people started to settle and focus, and being farmers, suddenly that was the job that most people were. They were all farmers. And then you get some people able to accumulate more land, more crops, more animals. So some people really prospered and benefited from it. And then thousands of years later, probably a revolution that has impacted us more recently is the Industrial Revolution. So suddenly, when we have machines who are, help us make products more efficiently and quickly, suddenly the nature of work changes. So you have a lot more people working as factory workers, and then a very few people who are the factory owners. But also, you have all these products that you need to sell, and so suddenly you have to create a market and have more people being able to sell them. And again, some people really benefited and profited from this. And so work over time begins to be associated with profit. It begins to be associated with wealth. One of the primary reasons why we work is to earn money. And even in Ecclesiastes, in this time, you see that that's one of the primary reasons why he's working. He often will talk about wealth. So this man is working hard, he's accumulating all this wealth, and then suddenly he stops and he thinks, what's going to happen to this when I die? He's suddenly aware that not only is work fleeting, but like our own lives are fleeting, like poof, and we're all gone. And he wonders, who will get all my hard work? Who will, and what will they do with it? Will they squander it? So Arthur Sackler was a very clever man, and I think he was a workaholic. He worked incredibly hard, and he gained wealth. But then when he was 74, he had a heart attack and he died. And when he died, there became this really ugly dispute in the family. He had a lot of children, he had several ex-wives, so they were disputing about the estate, and also his brothers were disputing about some of the business decisions they had made because they were all kind of intertwined together. And the dispute got so ugly, particularly between his two brothers, that this fracture happened in the family that still kind of exists to this day, which was passed on to their children, so that the two sides of the family don't talk to one another because of business decisions and because of money. But once you die, you have no control over that, right? You can't participate in those discussions anymore. You're kind of left out of the picture. And I guess maybe for a little while there's your legacy. So Arthur definitely had a legacy, and a lot of his practices continue to influence the family. And for a while, as we saw, his family business prospered. But then that's even begun to change. So now, after like years of having really famous institutions wanting to associate with the Sacklers and receive kind of generous donations from them, as all these questions began to be raised about the Sacklers' family business and their involvement in the opioid crisis, all these institutions under pressure have begun to withdraw their support. So institutions like Harvard and Yale and the Metropolitan Museum of Art suddenly have distanced themselves and disassociated themselves from Sacklers. And so, poof, their reputation is gone. And then their family business has finally declared bankruptcy as well. And so this family business also, poof, is gone. Work sometimes is really hard. And sometimes it can feel pointless. And sometimes our work doesn't easily align into God's good purposes. In fact, work can sometimes feel more like it's all about accumulating wealth, and this can lead to another distortion.
Ecclesiastes 4, verse 1. Again I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive.
Sometimes our work can contain exploitation. There can be injustice in our work. When we think about our work, it's really important to think about the context that we're working in, to think about the economy that we're in, because the economy that we're in will actually shape the nature of the work that we do. And we don't always think about this because you just get used to the society, the economy that you exist in. But I think it's fair to say, I'm not an economist, but I think it's fair to say that no economic system so far has managed to benefit all people, and that sometimes the economic structures can feel like they take on a life of their own. So in the ancient world at this time, the economic system was kind of built around the king. And particularly at this time, there was a growing bureaucracy developing. And like bureaucracies of today, it was really complicated and frustrating to navigate. So the central institution in the economy was the government, and that affected workers and their lives. And one of the consequences of this was there was a growing gap between the poor and the rich. There was a growing social inequality, so that some workers felt like they were on the margins. And so they began to feel really isolated and alienated from the economic system. Those trends that we see in the in the ancient world have only kind of accelerated in our time. So today we don't just have the government, we have like global corporations ruling our world. And a few benefit from this, but a lot of people feel on the margins and can feel really isolated and alienated and potentially exploited in this system. Over the last 20 years, there's been a growing interest in helping Christians think about their work. I don't know if you've experienced that in different churches, but it's like kind of a booming business. There's so many speakers and books and conferences that you can go to, which is helping Christians think about faith and work. It's the faith and work movement. But one of the critiques that has emerged about this movement is that it tends to connect more with white-collar workers rather than blue-collar workers. And so sometimes there can be a failure in the faith and work movement when we speak about work to not be aware or to not speak about the economic reality. So, you know, this idea of work being your vocation or work being a place where you use your gifts, it's just not the question for everybody. Like, some people are literally just trying to get a job to be able to survive. And so there can be a disconnect. And I think sometimes maybe pastors and theologians don't want to talk about the economy because A, it's incredibly complex. You might be speaking about something you don't fully know. And B, it is like a lot of things, potentially divisive to speak about, right? Like different people can have different ideas about how an economy should work. And so it's easier maybe just to avoid that discussion altogether. So sometimes you might not want to speak about, oh, maybe capitalism can have some really damaging effects on people. Or maybe we don't want to speak about naming actual workplaces where there might be exploitation and injustice because there might be members of our church in those workplaces. Or maybe we don't want to speak about how sometimes it feels like the economy can feel more important than actual people or the planet. And maybe pastors aren't the right person to be speaking about it. I think this is why we need Christians who have expertise in economics and business, who can be joining in these wider discussions that I think are happening in our society about imagining what other possibilities could exist for how we do work. There's growing talk about, you know, the next revolution in work around robots and automation, that I think it'd be really important to have Christians in that space and try to imagine what can we do that could bring a life to all people and this planet? These are really important discussions. But at the very least, I think it's also important whenever we talk about work that there is space to somehow hear stories of people's experience when work is really hard and when it's exploitative or when you feel like you're on the margins. So one of the reasons why the Sacklers and their story makes me so angry, and you might have heard me mention it before, because when I was reading this book, I was really angry, was that sometimes it feels like once you're a powerful corporation or once you have a certain amount of wealth, you can kind of get away with a lot of things. And you cannot be held to account. So to give one example from the Sackler story, and there's lots of kind of layers to this, but one story was that they had an employee, and we're going to call her Martha. She was a legal secretary for the company. She started working for them in 1979, an incredible, loyal, long-term member for this company. In 1999, just so they've only just released oxycodone, they begin to get reports that some people are using this drug to get high. And so she is sent to investigate like what's happening. So she goes into chat rooms and listens to the discussions taking place online, and she discovers it's really easy actually like to crush the pill. And there's meant to be like a safety coating that's like to prevent people from getting high, but like it's really easy to bypass. So she writes a memo and she sends what she's found to the board of the company. A lot of Sacklers sit on the board, but they ignore the memo. In fact, the only thing she is told is like to stop writing this down because, you know, once something's written down, it could be used as evidence later on. Unfortunately, she ends up in a car accident. And so she starts to suffer from chronic back pain. And her boss is like, well, you should use our product. So she does, and she becomes addicted herself. And after over 20 years of working for this company, she is fired for poor work performance. She tries to bring a case. She tries to sue the company. It tries to expose what she thinks is a cover-up. She tries to talk about the deleted emails and the work that she has done. But the case is dismissed and she is portrayed as unstable. Internally, the company describes her as the scum of the earth. And the Sacklers' position, and this is kind of still their argument, is that their product is fine. It's people, addicts are addicts. So if you have a problem with addiction, then it's kind of your fault. You should take responsibility for it yourself. That's kind of like the argument that I guess the gun lobby often uses. Like, our product is safe as long as you use it well. But even their early research from the 90s, when they were first developing this pill, suggests that some of their claims they made about how long the pain management would last before you should take another pill was incorrect. And again, they buried their evidence because it was making them so much money. And so once you have a lot of money, you can get NDAs, you can fight off multiple legal charges that come your way. And if you're really wealthy, you have influence. So they knew politicians they could talk to get the laws that they wanted. They could lobby the drug regulator, FDA, kind of give them deals. Like, if you help us get our drugs through quicker, then we might like give you a good job. You can leave government and come into the corporate sector. And so there's all these systems kind of at play. And this is not unusual, right? This is one example, but there's so many stories we could tell where systems work together that end up being corrupt or exploitative or unjust. And I think it's really hard for us not to be exposed or maybe to find ourselves potentially in a position where we might find ourselves embroiled in work of injustice and corruption. I mean, yeah, I think it's not just the secular work. I think you can also speak about that when you think about Christian organizations and churches as well, that it's really easy to get embroiled in injustice, and corruption. That's a picture of the pressure that's recently come on the company to kind of change. And it's only because of that pressure and people advocating for justice that they're beginning to be held to account. So this is the distortion we might face in our work. I want to raise one more distortion that can happen when we think about work.
Ecclesiastes 4, verse 8. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business.
Another distortion when it comes to work, and this is focusing once more on the individual, is when work becomes an idol. And I think this is a real struggle in our culture, when we give everything to our work, when we sacrifice everything to our work, when it's the most important thing in our lives, this can become really dangerous. I don't think ambition is necessarily always a bad thing, but there comes the point when this desire to make a name for ourselves or this desire to earn a certain level of wealth can become really harmful. You know, today we talk about people being workaholics. And when we talk about workaholics, we kind of recognize that it's probably not completely healthy. But at the same time, I don't know about you, but I kind of sometimes admire workaholics. You know, when people tell me all the work that they do and how much they've accomplished, I sometimes feel lazy, like, oh, I need to keep up. I need to work just as hard. And it feels like it's the people who work long and hard, who give their best, who end up getting the acclaim and the promotions. But this writer in Ecclesiastes speaks about this man who has worked and given everything to work and then suddenly stops and he finds himself all alone. He has no one to share his success with. His relationships with his family, with his friends, with his community have kind of disintegrated. And I think this is a warning of what happens when work becomes our number one priority, that if we're not careful, it can end up really damaging our relationships. And I think in the end, creating a feeling of hollowness, like, why was I doing all this work? What was it for? Also, you know, a huge other issue when we think about working too much is burnout, which is a serious issue for a lot of people. Now, again, this is complex because I think wisdom is needed here, because I think there are some jobs that require a certain level of commitment, and maybe there's some seasons when we give work a priority. So wisdom is needed, which is what the book of Ecclesiastes is all about. It's about seeking wisdom and asking questions like, what is driving me to work and what am I trying to achieve? And so that's why I think it's really important to be part of a community where we can in some sense, hold one another accountable and have these discussions. I don't know how you're feeling. It's kind of depressing, the book of Ecclesiastes. As we think about work, Ecclesiastes paints this rather grim picture of work. It pictures work as being really hard, that takes a toll on your body and your relationships, and then you work so hard and it's fleeting anyway. Maybe you don't make a big difference to the world at the end of the day. It speaks about the way work can get wrapped up in money and the questions that we have, either feeling like we don't have enough money or what to do with the wealth that we have. And all the work that we're in, you know, in our companies or corporations or businesses or economy is kind of often has injustice. And so we have to work out, well, how do I navigate that? How do I be a person of integrity in that space? And work can become an idol. It can be something that ends up leaving us really empty. And so in some ways I feel like Ecclesiastes is like this lament about work. But even Ecclesiastes does offer us a glimpse of hope.
Ecclesiastes 2, verse 24. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment?
In the middle of the toil and frustration, there's this invitation to recognize that God is present. And maybe Ecclesiastes suggests you begin by trying to find some joy, some enjoyment in your work, however fleeting, however mundane it might be, to recognize that and to begin to give thanks to God. As we come to recognize God is present in our work, then I think we begin to have strength and creativity in how to navigate maybe complex work situations that we might find ourselves in. One of the reasons why we gather is to reorientate ourselves, to remind ourselves of God's priorities, because as we are reminded of God's priorities, I think that gives us the wisdom that we need to make decisions about our work and what we're going to do with our weeks. We worship a God who is the everlasting God. Yes, our lives are fleeting, and yes, our work is fleeting, but we worship the God who is everlasting and who invites us into relationship. And one of the gifts that God gives us is that relationship and his grace, so that even when work feels hard, we hold on to the hope that we worship the God who's able to transform, who's able to raise the dead, whose kingdom is coming, and we let that shape the work that we do. I want to pray for you, and I want to pray particularly this morning for those who are finding work really hard at the moment. So would you join with me as I pray? Heavenly Father, I thank you so much for the book of Ecclesiastes. I thank you for this perspective on work, for naming the reality of some of our experiences when it comes to work. God, I want to lift up this morning those in our church who are really struggling with work, who are finding it pointless, who are finding it really hard, who are wondering, why am I getting up each morning and doing this work? God, I pray that you might bring them comfort, that you might bring them hope. God, I pray that you'd help us as a community to make space to be able to hear the struggles and questions that we have about work. I pray that you would give us the wisdom that we need, and the compassion and grace that we need to be able to navigate really complex work situations, God. And I pray, God, that your spirit might continue to lead us into new life and into redemption and transformation. May your kingdom come and your will be done in all that we do. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.